programme for IT. And around me are various colleagues from both the Department of Health and NHS Connecting for Health, and also from our supplier community. We're conscious that this was set up at fairly short notice, but we thought that, given the seriousness of the things that you had put in your letter, it was worth meeting as soon as possible. So we're grateful that you've taken us up on the offer and come in today. So we're hoping to keep things fairly informal today. We're not going to do big presentations. It's more of an opportunity to engage and to talk with you about some of your concerns. I think you have indicated that you want to record the proceedings, and indeed we'll record them as well. We intend to make this an on-the-record session, in the sense that anything we say here, that there's nothing that we will say that hasn't either been said publicly before, or we wouldn't be prepared for it to be said publicly. But having said that, it wasn't our intention to publish proceedings at this meeting. It's intended to be a private session in that sense. Is that, are you comfortable with those arrangements?
Absolutely. I mean, are you intending to carry out any kind of briefing afterwards to the press, for example?
What we had discussed, and we thought we could discuss this as part of this meeting, was whether or not we could move to an agreed communique, for example, afterwards, that both parties would be comfortable with. If not, I guess we would, there will inevitably be media interest as a result of this. We will make a fairly short statement reactively, possibly put it on our website, indicating that the meeting has taken place.
Fine. Yeah, we're completely comfortable with that.
We can perhaps talk about that at the end.
Yes, of course. I mean, an agreed statement would be fine, but of course, we will want to report back to the other signatories to that letter.
Understood, absolutely. But when I say we're not intending to publish the proceedings, we're not intending to take minutes and put them on a website or to publish a transcript. That isn't our intention. But before we get too much further, I think it'd be wise for us to introduce ourselves. And if I can start here, the gentleman on my left is Richard Granger, who'll be familiar to you. And he perhaps will then pass on to other colleagues so that they can identify themselves. And then if you would do the same, please.
I'm Richard Granger. I've been doing this job for 3.5 years. Unfortunately, the sources of information that you have about me are extremely accurate. I was amazed to learn that I'm apparently a Porsche owner. I've never even owned a Matchbox Porsche, for those of you who read the Sunday Times this week. But I have bought a wheeled vehicle just in the recent past. For my 40th birthday, I bought myself a new bicycle, which is my means of transport most of the time in London. So it's good to put the opportunity to actually have a fact-based discussion rather than a polemic discussion based on what will make a copy that will sell copies of things. And I welcome the general thrust of your approach that you want to establish a reasonable evidence base from which to assess what we're doing, because we are often dealing with commentary which has no evidence base, and in fact Google enables a perpetuation of inaccuracies on an escalating basis.
I'm Sally Davis, I'm the Director of Research for the Department of Health. I'm on secondment, so I still look after patients in the NHS. I'm probably in the treatment
book. I'm Sidon Savani, I'm with Richard Granger's private secretaries.
I'm Patrick O'Connell, I manage health for BT. I'm actually here for another meeting. this was a target of opportunity, so I guess I agreed to join the discussion. It's a matter of program interest, and maybe some of the fact that BT owns a representative sample of each type of program we have, maybe it might be interesting for me to hear some of your concerns, as well as maybe tell you some of the things that we're doing in the areas that you might be concerned with. I've been in management with large systems about 35 years now. In about the last 24, I've been fixing broken systems for a living, very large systems. Typically, they're with classified spacecraft, so I can't tell all the sea stories about them. But they're very large, and to some extent, so I'm pretty comfortable with large programs. I am technically educated. I have a PhD in computer science. I taught at Meiji University for about 15 years part-time, but I consider myself a practitioner, and I consider myself the last 24 years. So I'm hoping my time here in BT, I've only been in BT about a year, and so I'm looking forward to potentially a productive career in BT and this program succeeding.
I'm Logan McNeil. I joined shortly after Richard to head up the design authority for the program, and subsequently more of the CTO. My background is again with Light Batteries. It's large systems, yes, central government, some of the MOD, which you may or may not be aware of. National savings, my responsible for the computerization of the savings certificate program, a lot in social welfare and DWP and the operational strategy. I spent about 6 or 7 years in the architecture of the protocols there. I'm responsible for as well, so they do work. And in terms of large programs, this is probably the fourth major government thing I've worked on. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say about my baby.
My name is Chris Loughran, partner with Deloitte, probably the newest member of this side of the table. Since a month ago, Deloitte began providing services to the National Programme Office, having successfully won a competitive tender, taking over from the previous providers there. So we have a team on the ground now transitioning from the previous providers to help manage the processes you would normally associate with the Programme Office on a programme scale. Planning, reporting, facility management, etc. My background is 7 or 8 years in systems development, and then the last 20 years in consulting, and I've been running Deloitte's technology consulting practice now for 4 or 5 years.
Hi, I'm Paul Jones, the Chief Technology Officer of Connecting for Health. I've been with the programme for about a year. I also hold a PhD in computer science. I was a university lecturer, very briefly. I didn't mind the students. Prior to Connecting for Health, I was with KPMG Consulting, working on delivery systems in the financial sector and in the public sector.
Afternoon, I'm Ian Scott. I'm here because I'm one of the national clinical leads for Connecting for Health, and I represent secondary care. I've been the medical director of the Ipswich Hospital for 13 years, and I'm a practicing colorectal surgeon. I suppose one of my main interests in this programme is the fact that I was a clinical lead in 1987 when Ipswich Hospital became the first major institution to put in system-wide, worldwide, order communications and results reporting. And that was a project that I was the clinical lead for. So I have an interest in what we're doing.
I'm Richard Lawford. I'm a professor of clinical epidemiology at the University of Birmingham. And I've recently been appointed the director of evaluation for Connecting for Health, working for Sally Davies and Richard Hughes. I was before that an obstetrician, and I wrote my PhD many years ago on the use of computers to improve maternity care.
I'm Richard Kemmons. The last 10 months I've been to Cognitive Department of Health as the director of IT service implementation. That makes me responsible in the department for ensuring the NHS takes the opportunity and exploits it effectively. Before that, I was Chief Executive of the Strategic Health Authority. That was the last of my 3 Chief Executive roles. I covered 10 years of a career NHS manager back to 89. Before that, I was a health economics proposition from York, selling consultancy into the health service and various other organisations. Before that, I was a student. My parents are general practitioners. I honestly say I've been with the health service one way or the other my entire life. And that's quite important, because I believe in the health service and I believe in what this programme needs to do for the health service and the patients.
I'm Gordon Hicksville. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the programme. 25 years or so of large scale IT enabled business change. At one stage, I was the government director for 32 software applications that were delivered in town security, still pay regularly on a daily basis pensions, disability benefits, sickness benefits, and all the rest of it. I was also chief executive of what is now the Veterans Agency, and joined this programme 2.5 years ago. I mean, tried to join it for a year before that and could get it to do this job. And got responsibility for making sure the programme delivered, meet all the milestones, life support, the typical basic organisations of the agency and programme.
I'm Christopher Exeter, and I work in Richard Grayton's private office. I'm responsible for external affairs.
Cool.
Thank you all.
Looking outside
of
the
university.
Yes.
Reciprocate,
please.
Start
at the end of the week.
I'm Harold Wilbank. I'm a professor of computer science at Swansea University. I've been there just a year now. It's a very nice place to live. I used to work at UCL. And I've been a professor of computer science at Fort University and a professor in the psychology department as well. So I'm very interested in the human computer interaction, I suppose.
I'm Martin Thomas. I'm a software engineer, and I spend most of my life, unfortunately, digging up the entrails of failed computing projects. It's nice to be in a position to hopefully talk to some people who aren't going to have one. Let's hope.
I'm Ross Anderson. I worked in all sorts of fields for many years. I worked in defence electronics, tornado, submersible stuff, maritime harrier. I helped to design an ECG at one time during the 80s. I worked in banking, involved in a couple of very large projects to put in branch banking systems, one of which became a death march and the other of which went rather sweetly. Because the second lot hired a number of us from the first project and told them what not to do. I worked in consultancy a bit. I moved to academia in 1992. I'm professor of security engineering at Cambridge. I suppose my most recent thing has been founding the economics of security as an academic discipline over the last 5 years.
Mike Smith. I would describe myself largely as an IT system practitioner with a sideline in academia. I'm founder of Medics. I'm chief technical officer, formerly with PwC for a few years in the global risk practice. And was before that professor of health informatics at Keele University, situated in the Department of Medicine and Computer Science, and was IT information director for North Staffs Health Authority.
I'm Colin Tully from Middlesex University. Been in software and systems since 1960, doing various things. Practitioner, consultant, academic. Less than half the time as an academic. At the moment, I'm director of research in the School of Computer Science at Middlesex, which means at the moment I spend all my time managing. We do have two centres within the school which I think are relevant. First is the National Centre for Project Management. And the second is the Interaction Design Centre, set up by Harold before he left for Swansea for our UCL. But still, I think our chief strength.
I'm Brian Randall, University of Newcastle on Tyne. I've been in computing more years than I really want to admit. I spent quite a few years in industry, first in the UK, then with IBM in the States, then came back to Newcastle, where I started a still growing program of research in reliability and security, funded by UK government sources, Ministry of Defence, and more and more in the last 15 or 20 years, funded at a European level. I've directed a whole sequence of big European level projects on dependability. I notionally retired a few years ago. Now I'm just a member of several large projects, and I no longer have the responsibility of directing them. It's wonderful.
So how long are we going to wait for that? Good. Well, thank you all very much. I think it's helpful that we all know who we are, obviously. And we thought we'd start by simply giving you an opportunity to express your concerns directly to us, because really all we've seen is what's been reported in the media and in the letter that you signed. So that's how we thought we could start the session. We can follow the conversation.
Yeah, and I know you have to go at some point, Sally. One of the things I wanted, by way of context, that I think is often lost is, and I'm pleased to have some medical colleagues here, is what we're actually about, and some different perspectives on that present in the room. And I appreciate you coming from one discipline and set of interests, but I know in particular Sally has a perspective on the asset that we're building and its value globally and to the UK and to the people that we serve in the NHS in England, which, you know, at some point you might want to share some challenges.
And I apologise for being the one who brought Patrick in, because we'd had a meeting and I thought it might be just a useful opportunity. Patrick, he's one of our major suppliers.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what side of the table to sit on, so that's why I kind of went in the middle.
So Patrick may not want to say it before we do our side, so
thank you.
Fully understand if you decide that you can't take it anymore.
Sorry, please.
It's... The letter speaks itself, I think. It's hard for any of us to represent the views of all of us, because we're not an organisation, we're just a group of individuals who have, for I guess a variety of different reasons, a set of overlapping concerns about the way this programme is appearing to be. I can tell you my concerns, leave my colleagues to fill in if they would like to. As I said when in the introductions, I spend too much of my time looking at projects that have gone wrong for one reason or another. Almost always avoidably. And very often when they've gone wrong for reasons that with hindsight, we're pretty stupid. And there comes a time when you feel that if what you're seeing happening currently has enough of the characteristics that you've seen in projects that have gone wrong, that you feel you need to put your hand up and say, hang on a minute, you know, before this turns into something that we're all bemoaning with hindsight as a problem. The only professional thing to do is to say this is starting to have the characteristics of systems that I have seen in the past that have not turned out well. And that was what drove me to be a signatory to this letter. I get a lot of contact one way and another, because your programme is so big and it affects so many people. And I think there is a pretty universal desire that the programme should succeed and that the transformation of the health service that you are facilitating should succeed. Because, as was said in the documents setting up the whole programme, it's, you know, the survival of the NHS is probably contingent on the business changes that need to be brought about, and they in turn are completely dependent on the success of IT systems. So, you know, we're all, I think, on the same side. But we keep getting stories coming out, some of them in the press, some of them direct contacts from people who are either working for the suppliers or healthcare professionals in affected areas, talking about the seeming inflexibility of the programme to meet their needs, the fact that they don't feel that they have bought in to the programme, they don't feel any ownership of it, criticisms of the technical structure, stories about delays, stories about cost escalation. Just a succession of the sort of things that happen as projects get later. You know, the famous Fred Brooks, you know, how did a project get 5 years late, a day at a time? There's a sense of things going wrong a day at a time. And I felt that, given that you weren't publishing, that certainly that I've managed to find, any really independent, objective, challengeable, auditable checkpoints as to where you were, or even actually, as far as I've been able to see, any really testable statements of where you want to be at any particular point in terms of output benefits rather than...
Just interject, what would be really helpful with these kind of comments is a lot more specificity. So, you know, the particular care settings that people have been in, whether they've got a product we've delivered or haven't got one, the particular publications, the particular types of data that you've seen on other projects that would allay those fears that are run by the bodies that have been published. So we've got a benchmark of our inadequacy in your mind.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and that's why I would like a proper review, that a really independent review to be carried out, to get that sort of specificity. At the moment, all I have is unease from the aggregation of stories that are being told, where I haven't obviously got the ability either to check the context in detail, nor indeed the time or necessarily the motivation to do it. My position is from this accumulation of things, it just doesn't feel right, and I'd like... I think if I were running the programme and I were getting this sort of feeling, I'd want to be able to lay that to rest by being able to show that somebody external had come in and, you know, been able to lay out very clearly where you were, where you were going, what the costs were, what the current risk set was, what was being done to manage those risks. And to expose that to a critical review from your customers, who are, after all of us and the people outside. But I've talked for too long. Let other people say what they're up to.
Well, I suppose my concerns have a number of roots that have grown over the past year or two. One is that every year I teach our introductory course on software engineering, and one of those lectures consists of a walkthrough of what went wrong with the London Ambulance Service. And having hammered those lessons into generation after generation of urchins, I feel somewhat disquieted when I see so many echoes of them being reported to me by GPs, doctors, people working in health IT, and so on. A second source of concerns is that, as some of you may know, I wrote a section for the NAO report on this project, and the research that we did in particular was a comparative study of healthcare IT expenditures, goals and other factors between the UK, the USA and 7 countries in Europe. This showed that the UK is in most important respects the odd man out. In countries with well-run health services that have got good healthcare IT, places like the Netherlands, for example, and Sweden, the approach that's taken is a standards-based approach where the government more or less restricts itself to setting standards for interoperability, thereby creating a market into which vendors can sell solutions and from which the local equivalent of acute trusts, community trusts, GPs and so on can buy them. In fact, in both the Netherlands and Sweden, the standard setting isn't done by the Ministry of Health, but in Holland by the TNO, and in Sweden by a cooperative owned by the county health authorities. So there is the fact that the UK is a significant outlier in this. Well, the UK isn't, because Scotland and Wales, of course, are following in something similar to the Dutch or Swedish track. And I suppose the third bundle of concerns that I have to do with safety and privacy. As some of you know, I was involved 10 years ago with the BMA in this, and a number of the problems that we wrestled with there still clearly haven't been dealt with. There's a range of little concerns. For example, as you move from systems hosted in hospitals to systems hosted in hosting centres, you may make the national infrastructure that much more critical. Now, it's not just a matter of some idiot driving a backhoe through a fibre optic cable on the A30 with the result that no hospitals in Devon or Cornwall have got any records for 3 days. What happens if, for example, there is a worm in iOS that takes out all Cisco routers for a week? At present, the damage that we would take from that would be no internet service. In 5 years' time, the damage that we would take from that would be a lot of dead people, potentially, unless there are appropriate measures to see to it that enough information is cached locally. The specifications that we've seen don't seem to give us much reassurance on this. Such specifications as are available on your website from 2002 and 2003 talk about information being held at hosting centres. Now, we know that since then you've got a split between the summary care record and the local detail record, but we don't know very much about the architecture. We're in the dark about these issues. And then when we come to issues of privacy, then again there's a bundle of issues such as, for example, the sealed envelope, such as the nature of access controls. There appear to be conflicting statements about this at a number of places. And I think it would be very helpful if very much more information could be made available about how the specifications are evolving and what the plans are to deal with issues across the whole spectrum of dependability, of cost, of safety, of privacy, and of course the broader issues of clinician acceptance, which seem to be at the heart of yet another bundle of problems. But I've probably talked long enough. Does anyone else want to butt in?
My particular interest for many years, as I said, has been issues of dependability, an umbrella term for reliability, availability, security, and the like. I was led into that work back in the late 60s, I'm afraid, when I and others had the misfortune of effectively creating what people believed it was a discipline, that was software engineering. We introduced that term through a set of very influential NATO workshops. But the term was introduced to indicate the need for a subject rather than the existence of a subject. And in the years that followed, time and time again, I found myself looking at or hearing of systems which were whose problems were very straight echoes of the ones that caused people in the late 60s to talk about a software crisis, and for a huge amount of attention belatedly to be paid to the problems of dependably and cost-effectively producing complex software systems. I was at IBM at this time. Later I was at Newcastle. I started then an interest in the problems of fault tolerance. The assumption that systems would have faults, that there would be faults of all sorts, and that one of the components of making the system very very dependable would be that of tolerating the faults that you would, if you were honest, have to admit would be there. I got quite involved with the Ministry of Defence. I was involved on BSAC for a number of years, at the time when I wasn't allowed to admit that to anybody. It became a lot more, Defence Science Advisory Council. It became a lot more open. I was involved in what I believe was the first working party in Britain on what was now called critical infrastructures. And that that report, I think, was one of the things that sensitised lots of government departments in Britain to start worrying about the notion of an infrastructure that was so serious. An infrastructure, not the sort of infrastructure that we get guarded by somebody standing in front of it with a rifle, but had to be guarded by people who were technically very competent indeed. Cyber warfare, another term later. All of those were sorts of things in the background, if you like. Now, from those sorts of viewpoints, the stories that I was hearing about various aspects of the medical situation in the UK, including, I should explain, through my membership of a very big, by university standards, collaborative research project called DERC, Dependability of Computer-Based Systems. That's an £8 million, five university, six-year project, just in its sixth year. It's run from Newcastle in Wales, Edinburgh, York, Lancaster, and City University. And a lot of its activities have been to do with computer-based systems which are in the health arena. And the phrase computer-based systems is meant to be large systems involving people as well as hardware and software. And that has been a, by other people's assessment, an extremely successful project. And there's a number of things I've learned there from that project and from the people involved in that project, which are background to my concerns. I'll just mention one. And that's to do with the issues of coding and the way in which different sorts of coding from different viewpoints can have very major effects on the acceptability of a given system to the various different stakeholders. And from knowing about studies within that research project on the impact of coding schemes, a coding scheme which was essentially administratively driven as opposed to one which was clinician-driven, I've become aware of those sorts of problems. In the last few weeks, I have, because I certainly don't claim no medical expertise myself, a considerable faith in the National Health Service. I've got the coronary bypass to prove it. And I will stoop to no one in my my praise for acute services in Newcastle. I wouldn't be here if they weren't as good as they are. In my studying, or my attempting to study, from the certainly voluminous information on the web from CFH, I have not been able to find sort of information that I would be looking for, which was encapsulated in terms like dependability case. What would constitute the acceptably believable argument that a given system will achieve some given pre-specified dependability? I'm not talking about one number. Dependability means lots of different things to lots of different people. So you're talking about dependability from the point of view of a medical secretary or a GP. There's different aspects of dependability. I've spent more time than I would have expected trying to find that information and talking to some people trying to find it as well, learning that there were some very demanding criteria specified some years ago as part of the bidding process. I managed to find just one document on that, which wasn't dealing with the sort of issues that I was concerned about, which were to do with faults and possible faults. There are phrases like dependability case and fault assumption and so on, which I would like to have seen open discussion and documentation on. And the sort that was easily found and easily understood by the people who were going to be dependent on the system. I was trying kind of visualize myself as a computer consultant going to that website to try and calm my worries after seeing something sensational in the newspaper, and not being able to do so. Now, it's a large website, but I've got experience of an even larger website of designing and helping maintain it. So I can assure you that I've tried really quite hard to answer my questions.
Can I just add a couple of comments at this point? One of the things I'd really like is a list of all the things you'd really like in terms of documents. Yeah? Because be quite specific, Brian, about something you'd like. Yeah? Because what's intriguing is the machinery that was used to administer anaesthesia to you. The reliability data on that isn't published by a hospital, but you were quite content to trust that that would be okay. But notwithstanding that, there's things that you're an expert on that you'd like to see. Now, some of them I think we need to be pretty honest with ourselves about. We're dealing, I know there's some philosophical differences of opinion here, but we are dealing with a quantum of inexactitude between what happens with large-scale civil IT systems, which is why I like your dependability concept, and the pronouncements that the manufacturers of equipment would make. Yeah? So the way we have dealt with it, and we, I think, are the only public service organisation in the country that publishes the service level performance of our suppliers. Now, I don't think anybody else is doing that. The suppliers, and it's one of the reasons I'm pleased Patrick's here, they have the obligation to fulfil those requirements. And quite a lot of the documents that you want aren't actually in my possession, they're in their possession. Yeah? So by getting this inventory of what you want, because we are not building most of these systems in-house. I mean, there are some things that we've built in-house, like the bowel cancer screening system that's ready to roll and people want to start deploying it. But for the most part, the systems are being delivered, and the service is being delivered by contractors. So we've got an output-based specification, which you have seen a version of from the past, and if there's a case for publishing a lot more detail around that, message specs, doing more of what's done in countries like Denmark as well, which I've looked at, we're very open to doing that. Just want the shopping list, and some of it will go off to the suppliers, and there'll have to be a haggle with them because some of it they may consider to be proprietary information. I mean, you know, I don't want to talk briefly, Patrick, about large volumes of hardware that you had to lay out above and beyond your original estimates to fulfil our SLA-driven approach in terms of reliability.
If I could interrupt just for a moment, in case there's been a misunderstanding. I was seeking this information in connection with this current concern. I am not seeking to spend, you know, my next 6 months or my next year actually helping with a technical audit. There are better people than that to do so. So
no, this is just.
So it's not a question of providing to us.
No,
I think
but
it's providing to
people. You might represent a balanced viewpoint of what we might reasonably publish. Yeah, from a variety of perspectives. Yeah, I'm quite open to that. We have tried to publish a lot more material than any other public service organisation running an IT program in this country. We haven't published the right stuff and some of it's out of date. Yeah, pull us up on that and we will try to address that. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's good because if the other organisations publish the same data, we might have picked on them as well. So this is a good start.
This is about what I'm responsible for and what I can do. I mean, if other organisations don't want to publish their service levels, you know, on these commercial websites that aren't available a lot of the time, that's really.
Let me understand what you're saying. You're saying when it comes to issues like dependability cases, which are fundamental to whether the system will ever actually deliver what you need to the clinicians, you don't have access to the documents that would enable you to have confidence that you're going to achieve that. You would have to turn to the supplier.
Depends on the specifics, which is why I'm asking you to be specific, because in the commissioning and acceptance process, we will go through an assessment of adequacy prior to allowing issuing a certificate that allows people to operate. But this isn't like a railway, is it, gentlemen? There is no well-established safety case methodology for commissioning IT systems into healthcare.
Oh, there's some very well-established safety case methodology for commissioning critical systems, and healthcare is, you know, just a variant on that. I mean, you know, we can deluge you with stuff about how to do dependability tests.
If I get your original point, I think that Richard or Connecting for Health has the documentation they need to take the overview. So I think maybe put your words in your mouth that the depth of the detail and probably the breadth of the detail is probably in a contract organization such as BT, because how much documentation do you want to keep it central? You know, we're all doing something a little bit different. But from our standpoint, if I could speak to the point about security, to some extent I thought you were probably talking about BT versus Connecting for Health. I can see why I was grabbed to come in here. But it's a moment of context first. And instead of working with large programs for 24 years, all of them have been where the data was important. It was typically classified, and the wrong people viewing the data or the wrong people corrupting the data was considered to be grave. The issue of here in this program, you have, I would say, personal damage, you know, in the sense of if data is handled inappropriately or not protected or not safe, or the system is not secure, what I was working with was that the nation would be damaged if such data was viewed inappropriately or corrupted. The point of that is that I would say that either I or BT or both at this point are very concerned about security. We're very concerned about availability, dependability. And one of the first things, and because it's in my background at this point, one of the first things that I did when I arrived last year was to try to call in an external audit from a company that works with very large systems, global systems, high volumes of data, by definition, to some extent, distributed because it's a global system, but I would say the primary data is centralized. And we took a look at the systems and tried to decide whether or not we felt we were safe, we felt we were secure, and that we had sufficient protection in place. And I would be happy to discuss that with you, because we felt that at the time, I guess it was a discussion of, I think that we had done what we should have done in terms of from fulfilling the contract, but we felt like there was more that could be done. So I would say that we have actually gone above and beyond to ensure that the spirit of the law was satisfied, as well as what I'll say, the letter of the law, because there's a lot of discussions about what fulfills a requirement. But from a BT standpoint, I'm thinking about what I'm trying to say right here, but because I don't want to go too far down the path, but I think that I'm willing to engage in discussions, you know, that you might like to have, in an informal, not so much in a matter of turning documentation over, because I'm not sure where the proprietary line is on that, but I'm happy to discuss the security that we have, because we own a spine, we own LSD, and we have an M3, but I would say probably in a very macro sense, you know, I think that we have excellent security. I think that you would be reassured if you discussed it with us. I don't think that you probably heard, well, not that I know of, which I'd like to know, anybody from BT having significant issues with the program in terms of technically sound, in terms of resilience, and in terms of security, because I don't think that we view it that way. I don't mean that it's not without its difficulties or not without its noise. Every national transformation program that I've been on, this is the fourth national transformation program, which to me means it's more than a collection of IT contracts. It changes the way people work, it changes the paradigm, so there's and it affects so many people, it's hard to tell the mean from the outliers. But all that aside, goodness and badness sound the same about this stage of the program. From my standpoint, I think it's proceeding nominally. But to the point of security, we would be happy to engage in some discussion with you in a BT sense on this particular issue to talk about these things. We think we actually have good security, and I hope to turn it into a marketing opportunity where you all are impressed when you leave and say, I think it's actually going fairly well. I mean, it's not just the physical security, which everybody kind of does up front with fences, but from a process security, from an encryption standpoint, from a module standpoint, from an information governance standpoint, from top to bottom, we do network intrusions that are not required by the contract because as a large company, you know, managing financial systems such as Reuters and all kinds of systems, we're using, you know, intruder detection from outside the wall, we're doing intruder detection from inside the wall. When we move applications from a trust into a data center, for example, you know, not only do we have very secure means for doing that, but we try to remove, like a Windows program, everybody talks about Windows, well, it is as it appears, but we understand that, and so we go through a pretty rigorous process to remove the vulnerabilities from these programs and make them very secure, and then we constantly test them inside. And so, to some extent, we would be happy to talk with somebody about that in terms of security for that one point right there. So I don't know that I would necessarily turn over documentation for review. I may do that. It's just a matter of I have to think about what I'm turning over and what does it mean. But in a principal sense, I would be happy to engage with you, probably not me personally, because my level of knowledge goes to a certain depth and it's somewhat vertical. But to have some of our team talk with you all about that, to give you some information that you probably wouldn't have and you wouldn't necessarily get from Richard's group.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we need to keep sight of is the status quo.
Can I comment?
Yeah.
I've been sticking my head into this, and I don't remember the detail of the program, and that wasn't why I've joined this. But thinking, and Dr. Scott will be important on this as well, and Richard also, about the reality of present care in the NHS. And I see patients where things are missing, important results, we scurry around, we waste their time, we waste my time. I see patients where things are misfiled. I see patients where I say, I sent you to a GP, or I asked you to go a year ago to get this injection. Do you have any idea? Did you? No, I can't remember. Or they say, yes, but I don't know which one I got. And I'm left treating patients, kind of half, well, perhaps not half, I guess work in my hospital is supposed to have quite a good record for notes being in clinic. And on a kind of light note, I should say on the security issue, if it all fell over, that when the doctors in Israel went on strike for 3 months, the death rates went down. So maybe.
School by iatrogenic medicine.
Sorry?
School by iatrogenic medicine.
Yes, and many of us around this table are well aware of it. So what we're trying to do with this, and why I support it strongly, is improve care dramatically. Now, I doubt whether, to start with, we'll improve it to perfection. And I doubt it because people take a long time to get used to change, a long time to get used to new systems. So I'm a haematologist, and when we've introduced new pathology systems, we've always had hiccups, and they take a long time for technicians and doctors and staff to get used to the new system and to come to terms with it. And sometimes people say, well, the old system's better, but usually in time when they get used to them, they say, yeah, this is fine. But it takes an accommodation, and it's always amazed me how long, but then I rather like change. I had to have my hips x-rayed about 3 years ago. I went to the Hammersmith. By the time I got upstairs again to the physician, he had it on his tacks. He looked at it and said, oh, sorry, here's a mistake. You've got rather thin bones there. Perhaps you've got some osteoporosis. You are, after all, middle-aged. He rang up a colleague who looked at it and said, no, it's all right for her age. But that is the type of system we don't have in my hospital. That's what these guys promised me. That I can send patients for an x-ray, I'll be able to visualize it as soon as it's done, and treat them. I mean, so I think we've got, when I hear this sort of conversation, I want to get it in perspective. Where are we now, and where are we trying to get to? And even if it isn't perfection, will it be a lot better? I actually think Thames Circle is different, let me say.
I think you've misheard what we're saying. We're on your side. We want it to succeed and get all those benefits. And a point Richard made earlier about IT as a recent technology. I was reading on the train about Peugeot. They invested almost $3 billion in developing a new car. And they say 6,000 people as well. But $3 billion for a car. Cars have been around for about a century. And it's just one car, that's money. And the NHS perhaps not putting enough money into it.
I'm forgetting
the
But one of the things one of you suggested was the Dutch had different systems. Well, my patients go all over the country. They go, and then they go discoing, and they get sick. So actually, I do want a system where they can, the doctors were in Birmingham, can see what happened in West London when I last looked after them, or I can see that they were in Birmingham. So I do want a national system to look after my patients. So, I mean, I would counter with, that's what I need to look after my patients. What I wanted to say, which was why I joined you, because I thought it was worth raising, was actually about this system and what it offers us as a nation, not just for looking after people better, but actually for research and for us as a nation broader than that. We do coronary artery bypass grafts. Well, do we do them well in every hospital? Are the outcomes as optimal as they could be? Would it be better if we used a different anesthetic or a different way of grafting or the vein from somewhere different? How will we know unless we get the data? You would be horrified, which of us is always better on this sort of thing than me, with the amount of medicine that is practiced on you and our society that is not evidence-based. It is horrendously shocking, which is why the government has a new R&D strategy and we're putting many more millions into research. We need the evidence to improve the care we all get. And this system should allow us to collect that evidence anonymised, respecting privacy, and deliver. So that's one side. I care dramatically about giving better services. Without a system that collects the data from across the country, we can't get that evidence and we can't improve our services. We can't prove that that doc should never be allowed to do plumbing at home, let alone in a patient. And that person is absolutely wonderful. And the other bit around this is UK PLC. From the UK Clinical Research Collaboration, which is a group of stakeholders interested in research, including Pharma, which I chair, and has a website, UK PLC, we commissioned McKinsey's to look at what was the USP, or what are they, for Britain in research. And one of them, undoubtedly, would be this sort of anonymised, secure, key, or consensus data for research. It is seen as that potential that we really have. Scotland already has some, which is doing some very good work with memos. There's also the GP research database, you know, where 10% of general practitioners have patients they assign. This could help UK PLC as well as our services. So I just wanted to kind of put over that side, which needs to be got in balance, about what are we trying to achieve, but it sounds as if I didn't need to make those comments.
I think we all share that view, and from the very limited evidence, at least, that I've seen, which by its very nature tends to be second-hand or hearsay, it seems that that viewpoint that the IT provisioning for the health service needs to be vastly improved is widely shared throughout the medical community. If they express doubts, the doubts will be about whether this program will deliver what they want. But very often, I guess, those doubts are not necessarily evidence-based. And I think it's a concern to try and resolve and investigate these conflicting views on precisely the basis of the viewpoint you've expressed that's motivating us. Now, if I were to respond to Richard and ask what my particular interest would be, then it would start, I think, exactly there. If I were to be involved in a review, which I very much doubt I would be able to be, given the other things I have to do. I want to look at the process needs throughout the health service and their degrees of variability and what information and data we have about them, and then look at the high-level requirement specifications for the IT program and see how they matched. To satisfy me, this is not an IT-driven thing, but a business-driven thing. The other interest I have is a particular concern and quite a bit of knowledge about the factors that influence project outcomes, particularly the big ones. And within the National Centre, we have a lot of data on that. And there are a large number of proposed factors that influence outcomes. And of course, there are no single ones that you can focus on. It's always a combination of factors that determine successful failure. So the knowledge of those factors sensitizes me to things to look for. And that's the other thing I'd like to do, if I were a reviewer, which I probably won't be, is to go on a hunt for those factors and see how relatively the program is performing on each of those spectra, because they are spectra, they're not black or white. So I thought, Sally, your contribution was or what you just said, was extremely helpful.
Where are you going to set the benchmark, gentlemen? Because this is something that's intriguing for me. Yeah, 600 statutory independent organisations. Take the great success that's been primary care record computerisation. And compare it, for example, with the US, which is running at 15%. We're running at over 99%. And we have now got a few dozen records transferred in their entirety between sites, in fact, in the Northeast, on first best. And that was a standards-based, market-led, laissez-faire approach. Yeah? Are we taking that as the starting point for what we're doing? Or are we going to take the model for Denmark, the Netherlands, and Sweden that's evolved over 20 years? Or are we going to take the US, where the probability of moving any patient information between the physician's office and very good systems in the acute sector is virtually nil? Because that seems to me one of the things we've got to do when we use a yardstick around whether we should change direction, and you know, we are not perfect, and we have been doing this for 3.5 years. And the original instruction was set out in the context of efforts over the preceding 15 years, about which many of you are experts. And there's a place on the map I won't be going, which is Wessex. So we really like to know what the starting point would be around the status quo in the NHS and the comparative benefits and disbenefits about things that have been done historically. Because it's really a very, very complicated landscape, and it's completely different from something several of us have worked on, such as Social Security computerisation, where there were 590 offices, if I remember rightly, and it was entirely feasible by diktat to have a standard process imposed and a standard record structure imposed prior to then converting those systems onto the new national COVID systems, bits of which I also worked on. And again, when we compare different health systems, there are very different employment arrangements, protocols, governance arrangements, and so on.
However, how this project will presumably be judged come the next election, 2009-2010, will be by doing a visual comparison between the English NHS on the one hand, and on the other hand, the Scots and Welsh, and alongside that, places like Holland and Sweden, and who knows, perhaps even Italy and Poland. Now, until 3 years ago, general practice computing in the Netherlands was not significantly different from here. Dutch GPs would come over and be completely at home. people will go backwards and forwards between conferences. They're now going one route and we're going another route. Now, the project may not impact as severely on GPs as an acute trust, but when it comes to issues across the board, be it from research to security, there are going to be external yardsticks for comparison. And don't, for goodness sake, let's get tied up in process, because it's going to be visible whether it works or not, and that can't be hidden. You know, you can't beat how things turn up in real life. On another point, I had one experience that I thought had some relevance for both the point in security and the point in research. For a year or so, I was a declared target of a terrorist organization, the Animal Liberation Front. And how this came about, of course, was that ethical standards in research in the 1970s with respect to animal experimentation were not of the best. They weren't up to today's standards. And so you got a resistance movement being set up, which now causes serious botheration, at least for my colleagues in Oxford. As a member of the University of Cambridge's council, I was one of the people that the zealots were called upon to visit at home and remonstrate with. Now, I was able to remove almost all trace of my home address from the web. This PDS of yours, however, had it been in existence, would have had a material effect on my personal safety, because of the 1.2 million people with access to it, surely at least one would have been a monkey hugger.
I think the technology from the 70s today has moved on now.
The problem is you're making my true name and address available to a million people. I don't want that to happen. And there are similar metadata issues with, for example, referrals to sexual health services, with, for example, children being referred to social services, and so on and so forth.
Right, the specific information need, we'd like to take that away and set out for you the ways in which different types of information are dealt with, because when you move from the demographic information into specific condition information, that is dealt with differently.
Mm-hmm.
And we have got a public consultation process, which I hope has been entirely transparent and very well documented by Harry Caton, with significant clinical input. I don't know whether my colleagues could at the table and talk briefly about that. To try to find a pragmatic approach which respects the specific needs of the individuals and provides a system which is usable in often quite difficult and complicated work environments. And
I'm the Carrick Development Board, is if you like the guardian of the ethics of this program, and I think they are very concerned about this business of confidentiality and safety. I would say to you, however, perhaps in clinician, that one of the things that never ceases to surprise me is the fact that patients don't typically share their information in a way that we do not. They actually assume that the sorts of things this program is trying to achieve are there already. I would just reflect that coming to this, I was very surprised to find that 40% of the acute trust aren't as privileged of working in the sort of environment in which I work. And I think one of the main thrusts of this program is actually providing any uniformity of infrastructure within the acute service. And we are implementing products that are in everyday use, everywhere or somewhere within the country. It's not as though we're about to do something revolutionary. But I would just share the view, and this is one area where the National Clinical Leads have been working very closely with the Care Record Development Board, that there is a paradox here, that if you have absolute confidentiality that is absolutely robust, you will have no sharing.
And is that irresolvable, that paradox?
That, I think, is very difficult to resolve, and I think we are going to have adopt a position of reasonableness. But one of the things that surprises me in all these discussions, and I think it upsets a lot of people that work in the health service, is that we are relying absolutely on machines to provide confidentiality.
What about the professional responsibilities of the 1.2 million people working at NHS? We have dismissed a person who abused his privilege in using our information system. That is the rigour we have, and that is a very, very important point in this whole argument about confidentiality. Because if we are to have the benefits of the system, which Sally's referred to about the sharing, we are going to have some pragmatism about confidentiality and the controls. Now, there are technological aspects to that, particularly role-based access and the use of chip and pin, which is actually slightly better than the system we have at present, which you will have to accept. But that sort of confidentiality will destroy one of the main precepts of this program. And that precept, sharing, is what the patients expect from us.
That pragmatism may give rise to Ross being targeted by an animal rights. I mean, how do we exercise pragmatism? How do we value the trade-offs?
That is about what I was referring to, the management of NHS staff via their senior managers and their professional code of conduct.
But it's not only the management of those staff, is it?
My understanding is from Harry Caton's work is that they've drawn they're bent over backwards to draw the boundary in favour of confidentiality.
Yeah.
Because, as they say, trust once lost is hard to regain. So, for someone like myself, they seem to have gone too far down that direction. But it may be the right thing in terms of public policy. Ultimately, if somebody wants to get you, then hire a private detective, clever enough, they'll get you.
Well, this gets us to another point, that 10 years ago, when the BMA was looking at this, we investigated how personal health information was, as a matter of fact, compromised. And we got Sunday Times detective journalists who hired private investigators and so on and so forth. We did a survey at the North Yorkshire Health Authority, and we found that there was something like 20 or 30 false pretext telephone calls coming in every week. Somebody would phone up pretending to be a clinician in charge of a patient. And we intercepted that because we brought in procedures to stop it. But the Department of Health at the time refused to roll our suggestions out to the entire country. They didn't want to know. And I certainly hope that you can do a little bit better now than you did 10 years ago. Because it's things like social engineering are the huge backdoor in the system, regardless of the
one of the things we've done, and that meeting that occurred last August with the Information Commissioner, was we formally asked and supported a significant increase in the penalties for data abuse. Because as I'm sure you're aware, it's limited to £5,000 in this country. So we want to see the penalties for data abuse commensurate with the value that people place on that data, and we don't believe that they're adequate at the moment. And that's the official position from this department. So, you know, we'd like you to come and look at what we've done thus far. There are more things we can do that work within clinical practice. You know, we're happy to do that. You know, we are going through the process of requiring people who have freely accessed information merely by virtue of common practice and the clothes that they wear, to go through a positive identification process, and we're going through the process of identifying what their real information needs are on an institution by institution basis. This has not been done previously. Again, I'm not trying to hold out that what we're doing is perfect, but within the practical realities of getting very, very busy people who are caring for patients to alter their working practice to improve information security and information governance, we are doing a lot, and if you can help us to do more without making it impractical for people to care for patients, you know, we've got a public forum, Care Record Development Board, with a good mixture of people on it, and you know, we'd be happy to join in that process. I mean, I would like that. Do you have a perspective that we haven't had represented?
There's lots of sociological research on how trust is developed and how it's lost, and quite a lot of experience out of the work that Dirk has done that Brian was alluding to earlier about the the workarounds that people adopt when they find that things like security are getting in the way of what they consider to be their professional obligations. One of the conclusions that I certainly draw from what I've seen from that is that actually you need to factor in all those socio-technical issues at the time that you are designing the workflows and the technical architecture. You can't add it on later.
Absolutely. So, for example, you need to deal with the reality of a single screen in a dispensary being used by multiple members of staff, only one of whom is legally liable for the medicine being dispensed.
What that means to me is that if you haven't got clear answers that you can give it immediately about how this is being addressed and why you're confident it will actually work in all the places where you're going to have to roll out the system, then you can't have confidence that your technical architecture will actually support the work practices that will need to be in place when you roll it out.
We have answers to those questions, and in almost all cases some of this technology is working in several of the settings.
But the way you've been talking about it is in terms of...
Well, you may have a set of views based on research, expert knowledge of other jurisdictions, and previous things that you've each worked on, which we have not had access to previously. And one of the reasons we have not gone with a big bang rollout is because I would be very, very surprised to find anybody who's rolled out an 800,000 person end user system, the network of applications, that got their specification right at first hit.
So would I.
So I would expect that there will be a refinement to specifications that were produced 3 years ago and have been refined several times since as we've gone through incremental rollout activity. I gave you the example of the registration issue we have in the 10,000 community pharmacies, where there are an awful lot of form factor issues about where the screen is, who has access to it, what information can be displayed on it, which have delayed the program. We've had the core messaging infrastructure available for 14 or 15 months to move electronic prescribing instructions between the compliant GP systems and compliant pharmacy systems through the BT messaging infrastructure. But we've had to work through the real detail of how it's going to work in those retail outlets.
You say it's delayed the program, but
yes, it has.
Against the original target schedule dates,
yes.
No doubt.
Yes.
But it definitely won't delay ultimate success. The more you do like that up front, the more likely you are to achieve ultimate success.
Yeah, I agree.
I'd just like to sort of say, I think we're aware of the dangers of cumbersome or clunky equipment and the fact that workarounds are dangerous. And that's one of the reasons why one of the things we are concentrating on is the time for signing. It has to be as good as the sort of systems we presently have, and preferably better. One thing we're absolutely aware of, I think sort of Ross is good, is the fact that if it takes you 15 seconds to sign on, people are going to find a workaround, they're not going to switch the machine off, role-based access will be potentially compromised because different people will get access. We're well aware of that. And indeed, it's a problem we have with systems that are out there at this moment. It's not something that this program has suddenly sort of brought upon the NHS.
We've got direct experience of that in banking. We tried to get our bureaus to sign on with cards, and the ruse that we adopted was making the card that turned on their workstation faster the same card that operated the dealing room door so they could go out to the toilet so that they wouldn't be able to go and have a pee and leave the system logged on. The reaction was absolutely stark. Listen, Sonny, I earn 3 million a year, you earn 60,000 a year, get out of the way. Bang, like that. Now, the socio-technical factor here is that a dealer who's making 200 million a year for the bank has the MD's ear, much more than you have. And going back to the professional sign-on issues, I have grave reservations about whether you can get hospital consultants to use systems the way you want unless you can somehow sell it to them. And we get an awful lot of rumblings from here and there indicating that that sale has not been made. I would think that making that sale is now a really, really high priority.
I have spent a lot of time as part of my job in meeting the leaders of the professions, and I understand some of the rumblings that are around. I think we have to accept that there is a number of people who have been highly active in the development of their own pet IT systems, and they feel very threatened by what the program's trying to do. They're of the view that we're actually going to destroy all that and they're going to have to take this offering and that's the end of it. I think I refer to the fact that part of this program really is about improving the basic infrastructure that we have in secondary care, and primary care is much better off than we are. But one of the things that means is that these systems are things that trusts and individuals are going to have to continue to support. And as this program matures, the very best of them, I am sure, will ultimately be incorporated in the, if you like, the basic core product. But there is no suggestion that some of the departmental systems, which are of excellence, and I'm thinking particularly the sort of database around cardiothoracic surgery, the database we have in proctology, are going to be affected by what we're doing. We're obviously going to have to integrate them more closely with products, but that's to everybody's benefit. And a lot of the rumblings come from this group of people, and I think they have failed to understand the way this program has been deployed. And I regret to say, to a certain extent, no, to a great extent, that is a failure of the NHS itself to inform its employees about what this program is and how it's interfacing.
Have you managed to get your arms around the size and the technical challenge of integrating those systems?
Well, we have, I mean, presently we have 52 systems running off our PAS system at home, and integration is something that is an everyday part of our work.
And how many pet departmental systems are there in the NHS?
15,000 or something.
Well, in terms of configurable software items, where there is site-specific variance, we don't know. Nearly every GP site we go into has specific data conversion problems as a consequence of historical coding arrangements, which were perhaps site-specific. So if that's one definition, then you've got 28,000 fixed points of care and variation in each of those. 200 major sites of care with A&E departments, big hospitals, we see hundreds of systems in those sites, of which between 30 and 50 to 70 have back channel online interfaces to the central system in each of the sites. And one of the things I would welcome you looking at, which is why I asked what the benchmark is, if you take something I'm sure you haven't heard of, which was work we've just completed in Birmingham to put a new PAS into the University Hospital there. Over a weekend, we did nearly 40 system conversions between the departmental systems and the central system, 2 million records, 500,000 active patient cases. We had 1,000 users trained up and ready to go. We only had one core business day, the Friday, when we didn't have the legacy systems running. It's a much more complicated system implementation activity, frankly, than rolling out the operational strategy was.
I must say I'm taking great comfort from this conversation, because it seems to me that what you're saying is that actually you would welcome an independent technical review. We've got representative supply who says they would be very happy to cooperate with an independent technical review. That's what we're calling for. So
we've got no problem with that, provided we have appropriate governance, no issues with conflicts of interest. So the same standards that we expect everybody else who has access to documentation samples to adhere to, and an appropriate reporting mechanism. And what I really want, and I know the tapes are running, is if there are things that we can do better. I want to know about that in a constructive way with sufficient specificity so that we can do the better. Because the people that have stopped doing other things in their lives to do this aren't doing anything else for the most part. I mean, this is what we are doing with our lives, and we are passionate about this.
Cool.
And you know, we, by our choices as to how we spend our time, absolutely don't want things that are avoidable to go wrong.
Can I just pick up your point on benchmark? I take it you weren't actually seeking an answer from us during this meeting.
No.
No. I wouldn't want us to go away and you think, well, we asked them for benchmark and they didn't go as well.
No, it's a very interesting point, because when people talk about just putting a system into a hospital, I don't think, just the little vignette I gave you of one hospital in Birmingham, I don't think they really take that as the starting point to actually understand the number of records, the number of feed systems, the number of online batch interfaces, the difficulties of not being able to take the system down for a significant period of time, the requirement to be doing lots of complex data cleansing, multiple generations of prior data conversion and so on. I mean, it is a very complicated starting point.
Yep.
Yeah? With a very, I mean, uniquely, most of our user group have multiple university degrees. I don't wish to
probably add on to complications rather than.
No, I don't wish to make derogatory comparisons with several aspects of commercial sector systems. But they are generally focused on the movement of something which is very simple, which is money, as opposed to clinical data, with a workforce which is either driven by money or will be entirely compliant. Yeah, this is a completely different environment.
No, not in my experience, and judging from Chris's expression nodding his eyes, but.
Well, I think if you look at, you know, putting the finance system. Banking system in. You know, billing systems and utilities and so on, big chunky transaction systems. We have a very, very different user group. And one of the things that always intrigues me about the surveys is if somebody could come up with a methodology which was cost effective by which we could personally engage each of our end users, please give it to me. Yeah? Because the idea of a consensus across 100,000 doctors is perhaps oxymoronic.
Could I just talk to Kevin Ross's point? I didn't like any misconceptions left. The last point about our PDS, Ross, I understand. And in your case, I don't want to dwell on this, you'd in fact be stopped noting, so you'd have to be there with a lot of information about yourself before your record could be drawn back. But the idea that we've not been public with our specifications is. Personally, feel quite strongly about that, because when I set off, I talked to Richard about how we published not just the OBS itself, which was again put on the DH website for everybody to read and everybody to have a go at and bid for, but subsequently with our message implementation manual, the way the people can actually talk to our systems, that has been debated very heavily in the HL70 community. It's on the HL70 website. It's a piece of work that we're pretty proud of, and if you haven't seen it, I would commend you to have a look at it. And whilst I can't talk to the Dutch systems, Ross, I mean, I know a little bit about the Swedish systems, and I was presenting in Gothenburg earlier this year, and I got to this stage of the presentation, having talked about some of the programme, and said, I showed them the front page of the Master Implementation Manual, and they were all pretty amazed. One, that this was obviously an expensive piece of work from our point of view, from BT's point. There's also an external interface specification which BT responsibly goes down to more detail, such as, you know, IP addressing, those sort of things, how you manage the interface itself physically. But when they got to this stage of the presentation, most people were amazed that this was literally freely available. If you're a member of the HL7 community, or if you're part of this whole program, you can get at this stuff through. It's not at all restricted, and they have it, the French have it, and all the really very competent people actually come to see us, to talk to us, and gone away, I think, you know, fairly richly endowed.
As is the case with the Canadians.
Absolutely, yes. And I can tell you the Swedes and the County Council in Stockholm, recently,
are very interested in how the programs can turn out.
Well, I know when I was doing the NAO stuff, we got comments, for example, describing the UK approach as a moonshot. Now, the American moonshot worked, but the Russian one didn't. And, of course, this binary outcome is what I think we're all around this table hoping to influence in the same direction.
Yes, as you described in your history, you know, you had one very good sweet project and one not so sweet. So you all got some not so sweet.
And this is a curate's act.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you will find when you pull together some resource to review what they're doing is you'll find some things have been quite straightforward and happened in reasonable synchronicity with predictions that didn't have an engineering basis as to when they would happen. And you'll find other things, for example, the form factors around registration of users and access to a pharmacy record have proven to be far more complicated, and a number of number of things where we have had external factors occur. Yeah, a new contract with pharmacists or a new GMS contract, which have changed the landscape. And you know, one of the things we're keen to not do is bleat about things like that. But it is a complicated environment. There are a number of factors that we don't have control over, which are not within traditional specification and engineering contexts. You know, the industrial relations environment is very, very different. Not only the highly educated end user community that's very passionate about what they do for a living, but also the negotiations that they have in terms of how they get remunerated and the degrees of freedom they have.
Sure.
Well, this goes to one of the concerns that we hear from a number of quarters. Somebody once put it like this, that GP systems work because we, the GPs, designed them. They started off with 20 GPs whose hobby was writing computer software rather than yachting or golf. And over 20 years, they shook down into three or four companies. Similarly, you've got all these specialist hospital systems that were started by someone who had a passion for hematology or whatever. The systems that tended to not work in the old days were those specified by and driven by the Department of Health, you know, back in the days of the bad old IM&T strategy. And there is, shall we say, at least a lingering suspicion that as control passes from an ecology of firms that grow out of professional concerns and gets passed over to a smaller number of firms which are directed from the centre, then the problems that people experienced in the 80s and 90s with requirements for accreditation, with central systems that didn't work, with all the mess that used to go on, will simply get worse and worse and worse. And then, of course, there's the competition aspects, because, okay, you're trying to do what otherwise might have happened naturally over 10 years, as systems would become interoperable and some suppliers would have eaten others, and you'd have ended up with maybe perhaps three or four suppliers in each sector anyway. And, you know, maybe you end up with the same result that you would have got with the companies having different names on. The question, though, is what happens to the industry as a whole? There's an awful lot of people who are very concerned, who have worked for years building up the little company that produces its specialised system, and they see all the stuff that they've built, they see all the business being ripped and replaced. They see that they have to turn to export markets to survive, but they see that becoming difficult, because if you're a British company and the British Health Service won't buy your system, then why should the Polish Health Service?
I think there are a significant number of issues you raised there that we could spend perhaps have a separate meeting about. Set out for you the very large number of SMEs that are supplying services through the prime contractors. Set out for you the historical ramifications of supplier failure, in particular in primary care, that left GPs with no support, having to bear all the conversion costs when some of these small suppliers fail. We can show you, and we have published, but we'll package it up for you, some of the issues around the European accreditation model you were describing with some of these suppliers. They say one thing to the press about their adherence to standards, and then they fail the testing process for 12 to 18 months in some cases. There's a high degree of variability around their performance against a set of published standards, and the difference between what they say in public and what the results are. And we've had to be as diplomatic as possible about their performance on that, because some of them are very significant suppliers. The market, through the procurement process, did accelerate the selection activity. And I think there's a balance to strike, and I'd be interested if there's any means of assessing this at this juncture, between the high degree of variability which drives innovation and less dependency, and massive engineering costs of having lots of me-too IP fulfilling the same business function. And significantly in the NHS, people change employer, 25% of clinical staff move trust on an annual basis. And I think there's a significant training and safety issue with having a large number of systems with different UIs. So it's a very complex environment, and you know, we had, had to have time issues, engineering complexity issues with too many configurable items out there to test in parallel, upgrade delays with some of the existing system suppliers. And as ever, issues with some users having systems that allow them to do things very quickly that actually aren't very good practice. So there are some text-based systems out there that have a high degree of enthusiasm amongst their end users, but place very few controls on the quality of data that's entered into them. They allow lots of free format commenting, very little in the way of structured coding, and they have very few context checks on the data that's entered. Those are some of the most popular systems because they allow clinicians to spend more time touching and looking at the patient's condition rather than interfacing with the computer system. And the data they produce is poor, but they don't disrupt current clinical practice. So,
well, I suppose
I think all of these are exactly the sort of points which to me are special cases of a couple of general issues. Okay, one general issue is what we believe would be the value to you in achieving your goals. And remember, we will reiterate that we're supportive to the extent that we as outsiders and non-medics can understand and comprehend your goals. We're supportive, but we think that in order to achieve your goals, in a present situation, as seen by people like us from the outside, is that you need independent help in putting over the things that you're saying. We would also suggest that more could be done to provide the information which is acceptable to outsiders, not just to insiders. And the whole point about an independent assessment, not just by a small set of computer science professors. That's I'm sure we could provide some, we would hope, useful sort of pointers to some aspects of such an assessment. But there's many other facets of that assessment. Effectively, if you make the arguments yourself in the present situation, it doesn't work. And there are people who I'm sure will never be convinced, but that's not the problem.
No, I think you have great wisdom in what you're saying. Tell us how you want to do this.
Can I ask a specific question? Obviously, usability is central to the success of the system. If it's not usable, use it, and usability and security are, as you've hinted, are at often ends of a spectrum. So what processes have you got to ensure usability?
Well, we've got all the usual development lifecycle stages that you would expect to see around end user involvement for a variety of types in, both the requirements and the manifestation of those as screens, keyboards, reports, usage, and cotton wool sites to start off doing things and then the opportunity to have change on an iterative basis before mass rollout. We've got all that. One of the things which is a particular challenge in this environment is if you take something like Choose and Book, Choose and Book is requiring the completion of a referral data set which has been defined by the users of that data and a large clinical reference group of people working in secondary care. What would they like GPs to put into a record when referring the patient? Which then generates more keyboard time for GPs, for which at the current time they don't receive a comparable benefit in terms of the discharge summary coming back, because that piece of the network isn't in place yet. So it's the usability things are not just about some of the traditional usability factors, but also about a complete cultural change between doing something, and the doctors in the room can talk to this far better than I can, the immediacy of their professional duty to care for a patient through a care pathway, and the care that they receive in a different institution in a different building. And quite a lot of the commentary at the moment about what we're doing is about constraining people's degrees of freedom to produce a benefit that they individually don't receive.
Have you received your degrees of freedom? I mean, your profession is intended under the current funding to last sort of quite a few years and won't stop then. And I guess all the time the context in which we're doing it is changing. And therefore your views about the best approach within that context may change. Are you able to make those changes in the approach, or are there some absolute constraints that bar you from acting or changing or being evolutionary in the way you want to?
There are no absolute constraints, and what we won't do is do something that's no longer valid simply because it was the thing that somebody wanted doing at some point in the past. So
the contractual situation is adaptable?
Absolutely. And where change control notices are necessary because requirements have evolved, and Choose and Book is quite a well-documented example of that publicly, we of course will do that. And I think if you look at the OBS, which is an instrument that I successfully used on congestion charging, there were significant requirements and changes there, which CRISPR, the latter part of all, into putting it into production. One example would be use of SMS messages as a primary instrument for the public to interact with the public service, first time in this country at that volume. The OBS provides a lot of hooks for that. So we're not structurally constrained. I mean, Richard, do you want to talk about what you're doing in terms of kind of refresh activity you've got?
Yeah, and you may be aware aware of this, that one strand, because context is changing quite rapidly, and I mean, arguably, we've had a more radical proposition about the system and the way to deliver healthcare proposed over the last 18 months than possibly ever before. That manifests itself in the system for approach to the Department of Health. And, so that embraces payment by results, development of a much more plural, competitive provider side, the stronger enablement of patients to both use information to manage themselves, but also to make informed choices
about camels of care and types of care. So we have a very radical reform proposition, which is a subset of the public service reform programme of the government. Now that all raises lots of very interesting questions in the minds of lots of people who are both working in the health service, using the health service, and observing the health service. Some of the grumblings are actually people articulating their own doubts or anxieties about what does this change mean for the way that I'm being asked to work, and what does it mean for the things I thought were going to happen, which I thought actually, you know, we're probably going to be quite useful. I wonder if they'll still happen in the way. So there's a huge change context, very strong. Forget about the current short-term fiscal issues, which is also a huge change. There's a huge change context. So one strand of the policy work that's been done is a collaboration between the programme, Connected for Health, and Policy and Strategy, to work through the strategic and tactical implications of that in order to have an informed discussion about, within the degrees of freedom available, what type of priorities or evolutions need to take place.
Which may change.
Indeed. But 3 years in, coinciding with a fairly radical articulation of policy, there is a process going on to articulate that, which again is certainly the processes in the public domain. It's involved open workshops, stakeholders and so forth, and it will come to fruition. It will go from high level articulation of issue, work its way through logical business architecture. So what does it mean for the NHS? What is the NHS now? Because actually there's some quite fundamental architectural changes functionally. What functions now exist that we didn't think would and have changed? Which ones have changed? And what does that mean for our logical information model? And what does that mean for meeting information, etc.? So there's that process in train. And indeed, that process should be in train. It should be almost continuous. We wouldn't want to continuously review, but we do need to continuously seek to evolve.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you so that's the strategic stuff. Richard leads that, and that's ongoing. So we're trying to make sure we don't deliver things which were the requirements from 2 or 3 years ago. And one of the things, as much as possible, we try to do is to, you know, I've radically compressed the traditional procurement cycle. I mean, we did most of the procurement within a 4 month window. Because you might have noticed the traditional large scale system procurement activity usually takes at least one half life of the systems that are being implemented. Yeah. So you've got a major technology refresh and requirements refresh before you've even got the first user live. So kind of we are alive to that problem. If you take the primary care white paper, which says we're going to look after people closer to their homes, in their homes and closer to their homes. 3 weeks ago, we got a prototype up and running of open system-based devices that will interface through what will soon be a commercially available set-top box-type product into a care record using software that we have available. Now, it will be a long time before we start doing that out on a large-scale basis, but we have got, you know, in Paul's domain, the technology futures watching brief to try to make sure we don't implement things which are avoidably obsolescent.
Did you dose that straight back to any reporters?
No, because the company that's doing it, the product that they've now got boxed up and ready to go, they wish to announce to the market in 2 weeks' time. And they're not somebody that has made devices like this previously, although they are probably the best known component in technology.
I don't want to be, you know, to seem negative or be discouraging, but if you ask a university research department to come up with a prototype to do any of these things over a few months, it really isn't much of a challenge. The hard bit comes later. It's
It's actually making something which is going to be dependable under all the varieties of real use, that really can be rolled out, that can be supported, where there's sensible recovery present. You know.
But this is what we've been doing. So it's not something that's been built in a lab. It's something that's been built by a manufacturer to a price that they're going to make available in the market. It's something that's using mature communication standards, but is not, you know, just going to use Bluetooth because it's used too many, you know, too many watts of power. It will use all the existing tunstall type equipment that's out there, but allow other manufacturers to come in. So one of the things I've been amazed at in the medical devices space is most of the value-added functionality is still proprietary. And in fact, most of the value-added IP in the record, electronic records products won't interface to anything because it's also proprietary. And that's been one of the other paradoxes we've had to keep battling at, is the value of information is only really of use where the patient is or the scientist is, in the case of somebody like Sally. And the most valuable information is usually locked up in the NHS in the equivalent of electronic filing cabinets. All these nice systems that Ross referred to in GP practices that have a comfort blanket effect because the data is stored in the building until the box is stolen and hasn't been backed up properly. That patient in London, 25% of first presentation into primary care is through the London Ambulance Service. We don't have any of that information from the GPs at the moment. So we've got, you know, we are trying to do something far beyond the things that people like Kingston University were doing 3 years ago with some of these technologies, so that they will be much quicker to market by working with industry partners to do that.
Yeah, I understand that. I just have a nervousness based on a couple of recent systems that I've worked on where output-based specifications were used, where everything appeared to be going swimmingly until the delivered products met the real users. And then the real detail of the impact on the work patterns became apparent, and you got a raft of late change requests, typically hitting the system exactly the time that you get all the data cleansing problems suddenly turning up.
Well, that is absolutely right, Martin.
And what happens is that then the project slips 5 years.
Yeah, well, we have 78,000 people using patient administration systems in the Northwest that we've delivered in the last year. Yeah, that's pretty much the same scale as any of the large civil IT programs that have been rolled out over a decade. We've done that in the last 12 months. And at the last 3 months of each of those system implementation cycles, the quaint little local reports that people want that weren't fully specified when they came up with the original requirement have to then be filleted in. The physician order entry functionality that people wanted in theory, they suddenly find is going to be deeply disruptive to their working practice and completely simulated without the IT system being present. And then the clerk that was doing it previously has to have access to that functionality and so on. So we are experiencing that.
Yeah.
And some of the slippage that you see in implementation of systems through the LSPs is as a direct consequence of that. And one of the challenges we have is busy clinicians focus on the thing that's important and urgent, and the IT system that they're being asked to sign off the requirement for is going to appear 6 months later is not their biggest problem at the time they get
sure.
one. Yeah?
Sure.
And Richard is working, and suggestions welcome, on how we minimise that risk, because that risk has matured in some cases.
To the OBS point as well, I mean, what we tried to do with the OBS was to engineer it so that the first part of the deliverables are the firm foundations, moving away from siloed departmental systems. So, and then the third part, if you like, was the gloss. So we go through simple, immediate, complex sort of chemo prescribing, and that's the way the whole thing is structured, and that's the way the deliverables are structured. because your point, Martin, about the life cycle, certainly where we're, it's no great secret that some new primary care systems should come out of this work. We've already had our docs, our clinical leads, and other docs actually out there with the software engineers at least a year before this product will actually be signed off inside, if you like, the factory. So we are trying to, we understand the problems. And Fred Brooks is also one of my heroes, and I would give this little man to anybody working on any microgram. I've always got a stack of them at home, just ready to get out. So we do understand the problem, we do try.
Just as you know from reading it, handing more out once we've done the project.
Well, it might.
We'll stop them doing things.
I know Fred very well. I can recommend another book, which is funny until you really think about what it's saying. That's called The Systems Bible.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen that one.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of truth in that too.
I'm just aware we have a time contract that we've just excluded, and I would like that to be reported as a standard modus operandi.
As long as you audit it, it doesn't matter whether somebody has it.
It's just a standard.
I value at the beginning of this conversation, I hope this isn't the end of it. I've heard some warning shots from proper people about their time availability and so on. And it's really for you to work out how you want to resource a review.
We're not asking to review your programme. We are asking for a review to be held of your programme.
Right. Well, we're not asking to set up a review either.
Okay.
We don't have that, that's not our remit, or we don't have that authority.
Okay, that's a helpful clarification. Well, one of the things we wondered about, in part because both the parties were selectively quoted in your letter, was the BCS as a learned body and the NHS Confederation as an entity that represents a broad church of the user community and doesn't have an industrial relations axis and is not representing one particular group of clinicians or managers or something. We wondered, and we have sounded them out informally, if they would form, in your opinion, an appropriate governance mechanism.
There is an issue with selecting the BCS simply because of the existence of the IET, and there is a real tension in the community that we have two professional institutions representing software engineering in the IT. What that really means is that if you're going to involve the BCS, you really need to involve the IET as well. One way around it is to sidestep both of them and go to the World Academy of Engineering, who could probably be persuaded to act as an independent in this field. Indeed, I'm pretty confident they would. And they, of course, have enormous stature, equivalent to the Royal Society.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can take that.
There's a need to think of the various, I'll call them constituencies, where I'm even prepared to regard journalism as a constituency, though at the far end from from clinicians. It's a question of thinking from those different viewpoints, what would they regard as a well-chosen and fair and competent body.
Well, one of
so
the
not too many professors
yep.
is one of the rules there.
I would have no problem with that, provided it is clear and a matter of public record that the people concerned have not selectively produced material for politically biased think tanks, for example. I can think of a couple of people that show a strong interest in this who do have a political connection. And I think it's really important that we don't have that, because I don't want to, I am apolitical. I am a senior civil servant. I am not a member of a political party, and I have no involvement in national politics. And for need to effectively take instruction from an external review, it's very important that that external review satisfies the standards that civil service requires of the senior officers as well.
I mean, my sort of mental model of how it would happen would be that some independent body would own and fund the review,
mm-hmm.
And that it would actually be put out to tender in exactly the way that the audit of the Swanwick Air Traffic Control Centre was done when the Transport Select Committee
mm-hmm.
decided that something needed to be looked into there. And the, I mean, in that particular case, it was DERA that did the technical audit, and I think Arthur Little did the...
Yeah, maybe Elders.
Maybe Elders did the... Yeah.
We've had
I don't think they went bust directly as a consequence of doing that work, did they?
We've had Kinetic involved, which I think are the successors of DERA.
Yeah.
And they've... I don't know if you want to say...
Well, that was on programme management rather than technical audit, so we got a key bill of health on the scope of programme management, risk management.
Yeah. No issue with that.
And I'd hope for a governance structure which would enable the people who are reporting to us that they are feeling intimidated about saying what they think, to enable them to speak to whoever was doing the review in the safe knowledge that, you know, they weren't putting their jobs at risk by doing so. Otherwise, we're just not going to get at the real concerns that people are expressing and put them to bed, are we?
I'd like to also make a comment on that, the fact that to some extent, Connecting for Health is a public organization, you know, BT is a private organization, and some of the concerns that we might have about discussions would be different than a public organization, you know, because we're in a competitive marketplace. What I had said earlier, was that I would have to engage in discussions, and somehow you repeated that as an audit. I said discussions, you said audit.
Let's call it a review and leave in the middle.
Yeah, but what I was responding to was the fact that I think that we would share the concerns that you have from a BT standpoint. If we don't have a secure and safe system that we're building, we have a problem as a supplier in the industry as well. We take that aboard. It's a reputation issue, and so clearly we would, you know, because it's a reputational issue and we want to become a services company, we're really going above and beyond, and so we're quite proud of what we're doing and we're willing to discuss it with somebody. That's not quite the same thing as probably some of your concerns for a public sector organization as we have, and so we'd be willing to engage in discussions to address some of the issues that you bring to the table, because the other side of the coin is that we do want this to work as well, and if we had missed something, or didn't think of something, or could we do this a little bit better, I'm happy to adjust the organization to do that. And so I'm willing to engage in the discussions, and I'm willing to try to address some of the concerns for the benefit of the program, but I'm saying discussions with us would be a little bit different than a public sector company.
Yeah, I think we need to work through that. I'm just aware of time.
Cool.
Some of you may have homes to go to. I have my bicycle to get on the railway arch tonight.
It's a tough life.
It is. I think we need to agree the terms of reference for this review. And putting it out to tender, I think, fine. Funding it, I think we need to work through how independence can be assured. So the obvious thing, well, I'm going to get benefit from it because it's going to drive further risk out of my programme, therefore I should fund it, is fine in one dimension, but in another dimension it fails some independence criteria.
Which was why our instinct was the Health Select Committee, because, you know, they can call on funds.
So that needs working through, and clearly you sent a letter to them, which at some point a reply will come from them, and that's for them to.
Yes, if we were able to follow up this meeting by saying that you know, you were acting enthusiastic about it and would like them to act as an honest broker in setting it up, that would be brilliant.
And to
go to them with issues like the private public sector and how we agree with them.
This is a critical national infrastructure. You made some very good points, Ross, about what happens when you establish that and the systemic risk as well as the systemic advantages of thousands of people being alive when it's in place, when they wouldn't be dead otherwise, but being late, and the pluses and minuses around that. So the principles agreed, you know, we'd like to then get the terms of reference agreed with you. We may have to have some hierarchy of disclosure based on the entirely normal arrangements that exist between public bodies and their contractors. Recognise we have about 1,000 people working on this in-house, our contractors directly have about 10,000, and then there's a lot of secondary employment through subcontractors as well. So most of the work is not being done in-house. I would love you to come back to me with a list of things that we could put a publication schedule together for. I'd love you to come back to us with a list of things you'd like us to publish. Yeah? Because we have tried to rise to that challenge, and it was first made by Michael Cross 3 years ago. And you know, I've got no issue with journalists of good standing and objectivity being involved in this as well. You know, and he led us as the first public body buying a large-scale IT system in this country to publish the requirements. Yeah. So we have been responsive to calls to do things like this. And we'll continue to be.
Just one thing, that while I remember it, if you go to your website and look at the ICRS part of the website and go to the spec, what you end up with is a pointer to the original draft spec, which has been superseded on the on the DH website, but you can't find it from your website.
Well, the ultimate webmaster is a fierce
Sorry about that.
Yeah,
I've refrained from
making
minor comments on the website. That's better than over a beer.
Yeah.
It's the first time a website like this has been put up by a public body.
Cool.
And it's got very complex, different segmented audiences. From the concerned member of the public that wants to know what's going to happen to their clinical information, through to somebody trying to sell a product into the NHS, somebody in a different jurisdiction wanting to know what's going on. So if you've got suggestions about, in particular, comparisons to other websites that are better, you know, it's a very efficient way of us communicating. It's got low cost and low cost of posting onto it, so I'm happy to take that one.
So
you just made a very good point there, that basically it's, though it might be one website, it needs to have several faces, and so that somebody knows that they're going at it in the way that makes sense from their point of view and from their knowledge, and indeed from their jargon and so on.
So how do we want to get this set of terms of reference together? I mean, do you want to go off and produce a draft, pass it back to us, you know, we'll comment on it, and then meet again to finalise it?
I think we'd be very happy to do that. Have we agreed that the review would be essentially owned by the Health Select Committee and managed by the Royal Academy of Engineering and the NHS Confederation?
The
assuming that they all sign up to it, of course.
The only component there that I have any knowledge of in terms of their disposition is the Confederation.
Right, and they're happy.
Yeah, but other than that, I can't speak for those other bodies. And I would, as a matter of course, when we've got some draft terms of reference together, so at the first iteration, if you come back to us, write a submission to Lord Norman Warner saying this is the outcome of this discussion, and are you content with us proceeding in this direction? And the minister who was on duty over the Easter recess, who was on the radio, Carol Flynn, indicated that she was comfortable for a dialogue to occur. So I want to ensure that as a public servant, I civil servant, I do what places want me to, so I want to go through that process, and clearly the health solidarity will speak for itself.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
So if we get Dorstat via the press on your side or our side, then I presume the line to take is that there's broad agreement that an independent review should take place, and discussions will continue on terms of reference and related matters.
Yeah, that would be very helpful holding line to take.
But if there's also broad agreement on the overall goals, we'll be more than willing to make sure that that's clear.
Yeah, and you know, I could go further than that, Ross, and say that we would welcome constructive engagement that may help to further mitigate risk. And I've no issue with that. I think what's really important for me about the review is that it's pragmatic and constructive. So I'm not interested in simply being told I'm doing something wrong, which might be a tendency of certain.
Or indeed right.
No, I'm not interested in
everything
that.
Should be evidence based and quantified as well.
Yeah. So it's no good telling me that 1% of doctors don't think engagement has been to their satisfaction. Yeah.
Because it doesn't tell you what you can use for your deal, then.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Esteemed colleagues.
Yeah, esteemed is over.
That's fine, Steve. The most important thing is at the end of the day, as Richard has iterated, a submission will have to go to the minister to ensure their consent with whatever is proposed. That's absolutely essential.
I'm just wondering if it would be sensible for one or two of us from this side to stay and just agree precisely a form of words. If that would be helpful.
Just want to knock one out with an email over tonight or something.
Well, we may get stopped on the way out. It's not a request.
Are you expecting a little visitor?
We have been warned that people who knew that the meeting was taking place might be waiting outside. So, presumably you've got back exit. But
I just got my impulse to go back. I'm stuck to go back. Stamina.
I've got a back exit.
You've got a back exit.
What a wonderful idea.
But presumably, from the nature of the discussion and where we're concluding,
Absolutely.
And you mentioned also that you, in general, individually, you mentioned that you were supportive of the overall aim of the programme.
Of course,
think,
sure.
I don't think that there is a general perception. I think people perceive, because of the nature of the coverage, that it was a critical kind of attack. So
we have to have worries, and hence we're here. The way this discussion has gone indicates that there's a way of addressing those worries.
So
that's
one
more can we ask?
Trying to achieve success.
It'd be naive to suppose the worries could be removed in a 2-hour meeting.
No.
One has to assume that the worries that are widely expressed have some kind of basis, even if only.
I don't know.
Various kinds of misconceptions. They exist. Pragmatically, they exist. Therefore, they can't be ignored.
One of the things that's interesting is the result of implementing systems which are wholesale replacement of existing systems rather than just little add-ons like choose and book into a GP environment. There's usually then silence. And that is, from the user group we have, some form of assent. There's a well-documented evidence of people not using tools in clinical settings that are popular at the moment, Mount Sinai being the most extreme example. So what hasn't happened, which is intriguing, which is one of the reasons I'm pleased Professor Lawford's here, is we need to go and look at not just the people that have fear and anxiety prior to receiving the new product, but how people feel at go live plus 3 months and go live plus 12 months. And that data hasn't been collected at the moment. So the people that have been talking about their disposition to what's going on, and there is the body of them, are generally people who have not had a large-scale product, or the things they've had they don't associate with us. So almost all GPs have had a reliable network connection in the last year, and all GPs have had a new payment system.
Mm.
But they don't associate that with what we're delivering for the most part.
I think, again, an independent review can help you here, because it should be. Itemising the successes as well as the worries.
Yeah.
Quite clearly, I think it's essentially does that.
And it'll be much better for it to come from what is accepted by the various sorts of stakeholders as an independent and well qualified body to be publicising these successes as well as any suggestions for improvement.
Can I just throw one other thing which I meant to mention this meeting? We are going to be looking, as part of the maturation of our organisation, for an independent sort of non-exec director from the community that you represent. So this is a critical friend to sit in on our board meetings and to say things that people who are immersed in this 60 hours a week don't necessarily think. So that is separate from this review, but you may think about how there might be some connective tissue there in terms of 23 signatories of this letter, an independent review possibly done by a contracting entity and so on.
Yeah, we certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that we were here bidding for work.
I'm trying to retire. and we have to consult our 17 colleagues.
Can I just, I'm sorry to be ignorant about this, but seeing as it's me, we'll probably have to talk to the press from our side. I just want to be absolutely clear, I'm not going to misrepresent you if I say words to the effect of, but it was our understanding that the representatives of the academics who signed the letter expressed their agreement with and support for the goals of the programme. Okay.
Oh, the overall goals of the programme.
Yes.
I know that there will be individuals who will take issue with
specific
things on page
370.
Yeah.
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 Remember, we're not medics, so we're not, you know, that's, you have to interpret that.
Those words come out of my mouth. I don't want, in the next few days, there to be unhappiness from your side
I'm going to have to wait and get away. Can anybody stay for a little while and perhaps jump in words with something?
Well, I mean, I'm in no desperate hurry to get away, so yeah, a few of us will stay on.
I think we'll be best.
I think for the rest of us, go. I think it ought to be said, or what ought to be said, is the broad goals of the programme as expressed during the meeting.
Yeah.
Because I, for one, haven't seen a document setting out the goals.
I was making words in my head to expressing the same thing. I'm very keen on the re-engineering and computerisation of NHS processes, but I don't know exactly what the goals of the programme are, and you may well have a goal that I would think is similar.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm keen on modernisation, computerisation, stuff like that.
Yes.
I'm sure you and Martin has expressed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm happy to stay for some more time if people want to just tidy that up.
I'm going to make sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously we'll be circulating some notes.